You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Roberts has served as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for almost 10 years now. In that time, the court has handed down major decisions on voting rights, campaign finance, gay rights, health care reform, and a host of other politically charged issues. And those rulings have provoked debate over the legal and political direction of the United States and over whether the Supreme Court may be as polarized as the rest of American society. Back in June, I spoke with Lawrence Tribe about his book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution, and we are rebroadcasting our conversation for you today. I started by asking Mr. Tribe, who is a professor of constitutional law at Harvard, wasn't John Roberts a student of yours?
He was. He was a very bright fellow, and he still is.
Any of the other current justices?
Elena Kagan was a student of mine, and none of the other current justices, but the president was a student of mine.
Does that affect the way you read the court's decisions?
Sometimes. Certainly with Roberts. I mean, I was quite convinced that Roberts in the Affordable Care Act case would ultimately rely on the taxing power and that that would make it very likely that the so-called purchase mandate would be upheld. And
that's just based on his responses in class?
Well, no, I think it's based on the fact that having gotten to know him a little bit in class, I've followed him from a more kind of thoughtful perspective. But it was also based on the way he asked questions at the oral argument. And a lot of people read him very differently from the way I did. I thought the questions themselves indicated the direction that he was going to take.
Because everyone else seemed to be surprised, especially conservatives.
Right. I mean, it was both before and after the oral argument, I was on various TV stations saying I thought that he would vote to uphold the purchase mandate on the basis of the taxing power, and Rush Limbaugh and others said that I probably should be committed because I had to be crazy to think that.
For several years, I'm not going to talk about committing Rush Limbaugh, but that's a whole other matter. For several years, the Roberts Court was often called Anthony Kennedy's Court because Kennedy cast the swing vote in so many cases. What's made the Supreme Court today the Roberts Court? What's changed?
Well, I think it's a matter of convention that one calls a court by the name of its Chief Justice. It certainly does not mean that he carries more weight than the other justices, though he symbolically is the sort of titular head of the court, and when he is with the majority, he decides who will write the opinion. But in calling it the Roberts Court, I don't mean to suggest that it's a court of which he is necessarily the intellectual leader. I think it's a court really with nine leaders in many respects. There are so many perspectives, deep ones and interesting ones, that the nine bring, each of them, that I think it's somewhat just a matter of convention.
You make a point of saying in your prologue that you're not seeking a great explanation. I was even thinking about that word prologue. Usually it would be introduction. Prologue is more of something that you would put in front of a collection of stories. Are you telling the story of the Roberts Court?
Well, a lot of different narratives. We tell lots of human stories about the individual justices and about their interests in baseball and how their images about the world are reflected in their opinions and the stories of the people whose cases come there. But actually, we thought a lot about whether to call it a prologue or a preface or an introduction, just as we thought a lot about the title. I don't think one should attach much significance to the fact that it's a prologue.
Well, what about the title? Why Uncertain Justice? That sounds rather significant.
Well, I think that one is. We thought that what was remarkable about the current situation is that so many people have so many certainties about the court. They're certain that it's in the control of five partisan Republicans. They're certain that they know the direction of the court. They're certain that it is the most activist court in history. They're certain that Roberts himself is a kind of cautious incrementalist. They're also certain that he's a wily fox. But most of those certainties are wrong. And we thought that uncertainty is the main theme of the course and of the court, and that one can be certain of very little. And it's the fascinating uncertainty, you know, the uncertainty about exactly where the court will go, not in terms of the bottom line. Sometimes you can be pretty sure of that. But in terms of the reasoning in the opinion and what the reasoning tells you about the next 5 years.
Don't some people actually decide to bring a case because they have a certain sense of how the court is going to decide.
Very much.
Cases that might not have been brought before a different court.
Right. I
mean, and laws are fashioned as well
with the
court Supreme
in
Court in mind these days.
Very much. I mean, the court kind of casts a much longer shadow than just the opinions themselves might tell you. And there are a lot of litigating groups who specialize in trying to figure out what is the optimal time to bring one kind of challenge or another, and what's the best client. I mean, in one recent case, Justice Sotomayor said you really picked your client pretty cleverly, didn't you? And it's true that when the client symbolizes what might appeal to certain justices, that can help. And make all sorts of decisions of that kind are among the ones we talk about in the book.
A Rasmussen survey in March found that 42% of Americans are confident that the U.S. justice system is fair to most Americans. 43% say the system is not fair. That's a near even split that suggests one kind of uncertainty.
Well, in fact, I don't know very much about that poll, but it wouldn't surprise me if the 42% who think it's fair are the ones who can manipulate the system better because they can afford better lawyers. The final chapter of our book about access to justice, which is called Making Rights Real, is one of the areas where, although we try to be very even-handed and fair in general, it's one of the areas where it's very hard, if you care about access to justice, not to worry about the directions of the court. It's making it much harder for people to get to court, to bring class actions, to avoid arbitration. The slamming of the court's great brass doors back in 2010 for security reasons was more than a symbol. It was really a way of telling the story of how, in some ways, it's an anti-court court.
Well, doesn't justice require a good degree of stability, of certainty, a prevailing expectation of fair outcomes?
Well, there's no question that regularity, certainty, a degree of order, the rule of law are important not only for justice but for a stable economy and for a cohesive society. And if people lose confidence, lose faith, not only in our political institutions because of their dysfunction, but in our system of justice because those with money can access it, those without cannot, that really does undermine a lot of the fabric of our society. So that's a very serious problem. And it's one I think that the justices are sensitive to, except they genuinely believe, and this is not true only of conservatives, they genuinely believe that litigation is not a great way to solve many problems. They genuinely believe that dispute resolution mechanisms like arbitration are better.
My guest is Lawrence Tribe, who with Joshua Matz has written Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. The 112th Congress was the most unproductive since people started measuring congressional productivity, and the 113th may turn out to be even less productive. With the level of gridlock and polarization in Congress that we've seen in recent years, does the Supreme Court or the judicial system generally take on a more important role?
Well, I think comparatively speaking, it's inevitable. If the other branches seem to be either impotent or paralyzed or dysfunctional or ineffective or inefficient, then people look to the courts. But there's a serious disconnect there because there are only certain kinds of things that courts can do in our tradition. Courts can say no a lot more easily than they can push in a direction of yes. They are much better at invalidating injustices, at correcting things like the official segregation of the schools than they are at actually integrating the schools, actually making things go forward. The social
safety
net.
That's why it took so long.
Well, it's why it's not done yet. The subtitle of our first chapter on equality is Are We There Yet? And one of the big differences among the justices is that some of them, in their heart of hearts, think we're almost there. We can get there fastest by pretending we are there. And others think we've got a long way to go and we need to be more active.
You reject some of the ways in which the court is often characterized, left versus right, activism versus restraint. What do you hope to get at by avoiding those labels?
Well, that's the truth, I suppose I would say, because I think those labels are convenient, they're comfortable, but they're profoundly misleading.
So it's just simply people in the press and others who find them convenient?
Well, I think everybody does. I mean, to some extent, left-leaning people, liberals, I think sort of understandably look at the court and say that on many of the issues they care most about, the court looks like it leans right. A lot of the people on the right say, sour grapes, what do you expect? Elections have consequences. You didn't win when Reagan won. You didn't win when Nixon won. You didn't win when George W. Bush was elected, or
George H.W. Bush as well.
H.W. Bush elected, George W. Bush quasi-elected in 2000 and elected in 2004. And of course, we're going to have justices of that kind. But it's also people yearn for simplicity.
But don't the justices themselves get involved in this? Antonin Scalia condemned political activism. Are people who are very knowledgeable about the court just as prone to using those kinds of oversimplifications?
Well, to some extent. I mean, Justice Ginsburg, for example, recently, not just Justice Scalia, but Justice Ginsburg recently said this is the most activist court in history. And I think that's an oversimplification, much as I admire and respect her. You know, activism is in the eye of the beholder. When the court does what you think is absolutely necessary to avoid injustice and to implement the Constitution, typically you don't say that's activist. You say it's fidelity to the law.
So Antonin Scalia says he's against judicial activism, and then people accuse him of being very much an activist,
right.
But
I mean,
he doesn't see it that way.
Right. I mean, it's an equal opportunity sin, this kind of oversimplification.
You organize your book around issues that are controversial today or that reflect fundamental debates in the United States, like campaign finance, gun rights. Has the Supreme Court seen a disproportional number of hot-button cases in the Roberts years?
Well, compared to other years, it's hard to say. I mean, in the 1930s, the cases about the power of government, both national and state, to regulate the economy and the workplace were not only hot-button, but were centrally involved in whether we could get out of the Depression and build a safety net.
And it led the president to want to stack the court.
Right. That was not his greatest hour, but in the end, it was demography that changed things. Justices got old. He got a chance to put many people on the court. So it became an FDR court, not through court packing, but through death and resignation. But if you look at the 1960s, the court did some pretty dramatic things, like recognize a right to contraception. If you look at the Berger Court, it turned out to be very consequential, with the decision in Roe v. Wade being one of the landmark decisions of those years, a decision in which the Chief Justice concurred. It seems to me that whenever you look at an institution, which is one of the only ones that seems to be getting anything done, the tendency is to assume that suddenly it's at the center of action for reasons that are not just accidental.
Well, you don't write about the death penalty at length. Has that become largely a state issue because everyone already knows how the Supreme Court will decide?
Well, everybody doesn't necessarily know. I mean, certainly people know that the court is not about to again suggest that the death penalty itself is unconstitutional. But just recently, the court rendered a decision about the unconstitutionality of having arbitrary cutoffs for IQ in deciding whether someone is too mentally challenged to be humanely put to death. The death penalty is definitely one of the hot-button issues, but there's a limit to the number of pages that one can put in a book and still want the general public to read it, and this is aimed at the general public.
My guest is Lawrence Tribe, who's taught constitutional law at Harvard Law School for 4 decades, written widely about the law. He and Joshua Matz have collaborated on a book called Uncertain Justice, Roberts Court and the Constitution. It's published by Henry Holt, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a rebroadcast of my conversation with Lawrence Tribe. His book is called Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. It's published by Henry Holt. Your co-author is a law clerk. How
yes.
did you wind up working on this book together?
Well, I got to know him at Harvard Law School. He was an extremely talented student of mine, and he was also somebody that worked with me in putting together an undergraduate course. Since I became a university professor, I occasionally teach in other parts of Harvard University, and it was a course called Thinking About the Constitution. We were experimenting with whether deep questions about the Constitution could be made accessible to people who were not lawyers, not careerists, not people who were particularly focused on the legal system. And it turned out that it was a very successful course, and I got to know him well, and I thought we worked extremely well together. And then I worked on, you know, I recommended him for various clerkships. He's going to clerk for Justice Kennedy beginning in July, and now he's clerking for Judge Reinhardt on the Ninth Circuit.
Gay rights are an issue where time and demographic shifts seem to be going against people who think like Justice Scalia. Did you look at gay rights and the nuances of the justice's reasoning?
Oh, very much. I mean, in the equality chapter, we talk about the court's invalidation of laws against sodomy, even if the laws are written in a supposedly neutral way that don't target gays but talk about male-female oral sex just as well. They are laws that have been used to marginalize people with same-sex orientation. And we look closely at the court's invalidation of the Defense of Marriage Act. And I've actually followed Justice Kennedy's career particularly closely on that issue because it seems to me that his libertarian streak, combined with his emphasis on human dignity, makes him the natural leader of the court on issues of gay rights.
Well, what about the people who describe themselves as originalists? How can they bring originalist thinking to an area like this?
Well, it's not an easy question.
It's not in the Constitution. The Constitution does not say sodomy is not allowed.
But it does say liberty, and the meaning of liberty is never settled at any one time. When Justice Alito was involved in the argument involving violent videos, he mocked Justice Scalia's originalism by saying, you know, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is, did James Madison like videos? Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, one can make fun of originalism by pretending that it asks more specific questions than it does. It's actually not a method of interpretation that gets you to any particular direction. Depends on the level of generality at which you ask questions.
Well, don't issues like gay rights or equal rights of any kind point to deep flaws in some kinds of constitutional interpretation?
Well, certainly the big problem many people have defending originalism is Brown versus Board of Education. They basically say, we know, although a few try to prove otherwise, we know that the framers certainly would have been shocked to think that laws requiring African-American and Caucasian children to go to school separately violate the 14th Amendment. That's not what they intended. On the other hand, they used more general language that no state shall deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws. And those of us who believe that words like that should be given a meaning that makes sense and that does not necessarily involve brain surgery, sort of trying to peel back the skulls of the framers, but asking what's the general meaning of what they said, really can think of ourselves as originalists too.
Well, you note that Pamela Carlin calls Justice Thomas a Brown originalist.
Well, what she means by that has nothing to do with Brown as skin color. She
Brown versus that, Board of Education.
That's right. That is, he believes that the 14th Amendment means what he thinks Brown versus Board of Education meant, and that is that you cannot use race in assigning people places in society. Other people look at Brown versus Board of Education and say, no, that's not what it meant. It wasn't abstract. It was about not using the law to put down racial minorities. And there's a deep split in the understanding of what Brown versus Board of Education meant.
Hasn't the court decided many First Amendment free expression cases more than usual? Most recently, the James Risen case.
That's right. And well, the court has carefully avoided the issues of journalistic privilege, but it's decided lots of First Amendment cases. And there are some people who think of the Roberts Court as the most protective free speech court in our history. We show in our chapter on free speech that that involves a very selective reading. This court has denied free speech opportunities in a serious and important way to students, to prisoners, to human rights activists. And oddly enough, it has granted free speech opportunities to people who sell violent videotapes without parental consent to kids, to people who protest the funerals of dead soldiers by attacking the fact that the U.S. military now allows openly gay service people. We try to show in our book that the court's record on free speech is divided in very strange ways and in ways that are internally inconsistent, but not divided left versus right or Republican versus Democrat.
Although some might argue that broadening free speech to apply to corporations would be very much a conservative idea.
Well, the odd thing is that the decision that you are referring to, Citizens United, talked about unions every bit as much as corporations. That's not necessarily conservative.
Well, but there's no real balance between the power of the unions today
and the
power of American
corporations. No question about that. But I also think that it is very much true that if the case that reached the court, Citizens United, had involved not an anti-Hillary movie, as this one did, but an anti-McCain movie or an anti some other Republican movie, the decision would have been the same. The decision, I think people who think that by saying corporations are really not people, they don't cry, they don't love, they don't hate, that you would change anything, are making a mistake. The court's theory in that case was not that because corporations are people, they have free speech rights. The theory was that the freedom of speech is as much concerned with the rights of listeners as with the rights of speakers, and that it's concerned with the danger of giving government the power of deciding what the right balance is. That is, the justices who did what they did it not because, I'm convinced, not because they want rich corporations to have more power. They did it because they want government to have less power.
So you think that this is less about campaign finance than about free speech? What about the McCutcheon decision?
Well, the McCutcheon decision was in exactly the same tradition. The court is basically saying in this whole line of cases, including Citizens United and Bennett and McCutcheon, that if you give government the power to decide which speakers are too powerful and how to tune it down, then you are giving the power basically to the very people that you think are bought and paid for and whom we can't trust. The court is distrustful of rules that incumbents write that the court fears will be carefully designed to keep them in power.
Others might say that they're misreading basic human psychology.
In what way?
In saying that you can trust people to give a lot of money and then not necessarily any impact.
No, I think, Leonard, with all respect, it's not that they trust people to give a lot of money and have no impact. The court's opinions are a little naive. They talk about how the influence and access is not all that big a problem. That part is nonsense, I think. But what they really are saying, if you read the opinions carefully, is although we can trust ourselves to regulate influence. For example, they can say that a judge who is sitting in judgment over people who contributed to her campaign, they can say when that judge should be recused. What they don't do is trust politicians to decide how to regulate the flow of influence and access.
My guest is Lawrence Tribe, who with Joshua Mass has written Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. It's published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, some have advocated amending the Constitution to rein in the court. Do you think a constitutional amendment is warranted? Obviously, it's very difficult to get a constitutional amendment passed.
It would depend very much on what it said. You know, a constitutional amendment that simply gives more power to Congress to write the rules of campaign finance, I think, is problematic, not only because it's hard to pass, but because it's hard to believe that it would do as much good as some people hope. A constitutional amendment that, you know, Justice Stevens, the retired justice, has proposed 6 amendments. And when I look at them, I'm afraid, much as I respect Justice Stevens, I can easily see so many loopholes in several of them that they would accomplish absolutely nothing. I think constitutional amendments are, easy to dream about, and they're good organizing devices, but we've only had 27 pass in 225 years, and there's a reason for that, and that is that the Constitution, when you start tinkering with it, when you start playing with it, and I don't regard it as a sacred document, but it's pretty clever. When you start tinkering with it, you may do more harm than good.
Well, we did wind up with Prohibition.
And we repealed that in a short number of years.
Didn't you help Congressman Adam Schiff draft a possible amendment?
I did. I thought if we have an amendment, it would make more sense to have it written the way I helped Adam Schiff, another former student of mine, write it than some of the other ones that were floating around. But I'm not among those who's agitating for the enactment of that amendment.
Some argue that the Constitution should be amended to end lifetime tenure on the court.
That's a very interesting thing. As long as the terms were long enough so that we didn't make it sort of a 5 or 10 year stint, and as long as one could never be reappointed so that the independence of the judges was not compromised, I think it might make sense to have 20-year terms, non-renewable, and to have them cycle so that the life expectancy that justices now have, which is so much greater than it was when life tenure was initially designed, does not enable the accident of nominations to project a presidential philosophy too many decades into the future beyond that president's term.
For the public, the ultimate issue is what impact Supreme Court decisions have on public policy, like health care or the ability to vote. With your study of the complexity of decision-making on the court, are you suggesting that the implications for policy may be far less clear than we initially think?
No, I think yes, to some extent. The implications for policy are not always just linear and simple, but they're huge. That is, what the main uncertainty is, what is driving certain justices and how far they'll go. And to get to that, you have to read more carefully what they say and not only the bottom line. But what is certain is that decisions about our free speech, about whether we have access to the ballot box, decisions about whether we can control what goes on in our bodies, decisions about women's reproductive freedom, have huge impact on our lives, so much impact that we should not make the nomination and confirmation process as esoteric as it now is. I mean, we've now reduced it to a ritual in which the justice who is funny enough to say, well, you asked me where I was at Christmas, I was having dinner at a Chinese restaurant like all the Jews I know. That's great. It's a great line. But we don't learn that much other than how witty Kagan is. When in a confirmation hearing of John Roberts, he says, I just want to be like an umpire calling balls and strikes. Most people, you know, realize that that's not a realistic description. We need to get deeper into what makes a particular person tick.
John Roberts also stressed his respect for precedent during his nomination hearing. Has that been borne out in practice?
Well, I think he's been quite willing to re-examine and reverse precedents that he thinks are deeply wrong, as have justices on both sides of the aisle. Remember, Brown v. Board overruled the precedent of Plessy v. Ferguson. Justices who think that a decision of the court has been a terrible mistake are not, when they get enough allies, going to feel bound by it.
If polarization were a problem on the court, as some have suggested, how would you expect it to manifest itself?
Well, it depends. I suppose you would expect it to manifest itself by a much higher percentage of 5-4s along partisan lines. Right now, despite the publicity, it's still only approximately 20% of the court's decisions that are decided 5-4. And of those 20%, roughly a third involve quite unexpected alignments of justices with Breyer to the left, Breyer to the right of Scalia on issues.
Or Sotomayor recently.
I mean, basically the number of odd bedfellows in the court is sufficiently large that the polarization that some people fear, which is that it's all going to be driven by one particular and easy to characterize pair of philosophies, just hasn't occurred.
Some, like Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times, I think she also teaches at Yale, have argued that the court is actually aggravating problems of polarization in the United States.
Well, it may be that some of the speeches justices make, which almost caricature their differences, aggravate the perception of polarization. But what she said in the recent article that she wrote was that she thinks the problem isn't that some of the decisions are polarizing, it's just that she regards them as wrong. Well, that's her privilege. A lot of people regard them as wrong, but it was the theory of this book that preaching to the converted isn't going to do a lot of good. What you really need to do is understand the serious ideas that are on all sides of many of these questions that have no clear single right answer.
But when the justices speak outside of court and sound like they're entering into the political process, aren't they really doing something that has not been done much in the past?
It is a new phenomenon. I mean, the Breyer-Scalia show that's on the road from time to time where the two justices talk about their differences in view is a new kind of phenomenon. Many argue that it's a healthy phenomenon, that it helps to make the court more understandable, more accountable, but the temptation is to be theatrical.
When I hear about this court being more polarized than in the past, I remember back to the impeach Earl Warren signs that people carried around, or that William O. Douglas was called for his impeachment twice, once because he had a brief stay of execution of the Rosenberg spy case. Another time, Gerald Ford went after him. And there already was a justice who was served with impeachment, and that was Samuel Chase in 1805,
right,
charged with being overtly partisan. So
right.
Are things all just the same?
I mean, one can say there's nothing new under the sun. It's just that the sun keeps turning.
The philosopher Richard Rorty wrote that liberals turn to the judiciary as the only political institution for which we can still feel something like awe. This awe is respect for the ability of decent men and women to sit down around tables, argue things out, and arrive at reasonable consensus.
Well, I think I agree with a lot of that.
That's very optimistic, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also unrealistic when he says consensus. We'll never reach consensus in this country on certain deeply divisive issues like abortion, like gay rights. Even if the generations move, there will still be a very big difference between the way people in some parts of the country think of some of these issues and others. And it's understandable. It's not like a mathematical equation. You don't have a 5-4 vote on the Pythagorean theorem. We know that some of these questions are eternal questions.
One case close to you that came before the Roberts Court is Bush v. Gore. Is there a widespread view among scholars that the majority's reasoning in that case is some of the worst in American history?
Well, it's hard to count scholars the way you count angels on the head of a pin, because some of them are perhaps devils in the view of others rather than angels. I think liberal scholars generally think it's among the worst decisions. There are a lot of conservative scholars who agree, but some who disagree.
Lawrence Tribe and Joshua Matz have written Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court, and the Constitution. It is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard. I enjoyed it.